This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The march to spring training and opening day is upon us. Rob Bradford from Baseballs and Boring here, and we'll have you covered every single day with podcasts that aim to educate, entertain, and inform you as a baseball fan. Follow Baseballs and Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
A little bit chilly outside, 46 degrees right now, going up to 63. 75 tomorrow for a high, cloudy, then rain, unfortunately, on Saturday with highs of 74. But the good news is Sunday, the rain goes away, highs of 67 for Barkas, and there's another parade that's scheduled to roll on that day. I think the truck's downtown? Yeah, truck downtown, right? And then Sunday is going to be nice, and then it clears out on Monday for next week, and we're into Lent in the mid-70s and all that stuff. So I don't know if you're following what's going on in Congress or not, but another, quote, budget crisis, because they don't pass a budget year to year and they have to do with continuing resolutions, which leads to a big old protracted fight, not just between parties, but within parties. Who wants to what to happen and why, and the underpinnings that are reminiscent of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar in the Roman Senate. Aaron Dusso joins us now, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis, to talk about it. How you doing, Professor?
Good. Thanks for having me.
I don't know. Did I kind of over-exaggerate that or not? Because I'm looking at 29 pages of story here about all the different maneuverings behind the scene and so forth. Maybe we can start with some context of what exactly is going on with the government shutting down, and when the government is set to shut down unless they come up with a continuing resolution, and then we'll go from there.
Right, yeah. The deadline is March 14th, and so I would expect you'll hear a lot of big statements until then. Usually we like to wait till 11th hour in order to get these things done. But because the Republicans are looking to really pass President Trump's big, beautiful bill through the reconciliation process, my guess is they will be less willing to fight right now. They're going to look to just pass a continuing resolution through the end of the year so that they can really focus on this continuing resolution and the big, beautiful bill.
So, oh boy, so many questions. For people that don't know, what is a continuing resolution, and how did the government get into the continuing resolution business when it comes to budgeting?
Well, so a continuing resolution is just to say that they passed this resolution saying we're going to fund the government at the current levels until X time. It could be a year. It could be a while. Usually they'll do it for a short period of time, for a few months or 6 months at the longest. They do this because really it's a political breakdown. So people over the years have realized that they can use this brinkmanship to try and extract some benefits from the other side. So maybe cuts to the budget in places that the other side might not want to do. So it's become pretty common now. I mean, we've talked about it a lot, and to have a situation where it's shut down or we have a continuing resolution shut down or not. This is politics as it is today.
When was the last time, do you know, historically, that we had a budget, like, from year to year, and they didn't play the continuing resolution political game?
I don't have it offhand. I know they did back in the 90s, but maybe during the Bush administration.
Well, once they find a way for leverage, look out. It never goes back, does it? Do you think it'll ever go back to?
I think that this is too useful a tool for politicians to give up.
There's a lot of tools. I'll go along with that. Let's talk about who wants what with this. First of all, big, beautiful bill. Let's get back to that. That's a big phrase. I don't quite know what that means. Who's looking for a big, beautiful bill, and what would that look like?
So Trump needs to have, what he wants anyway, is one bill that's going to include both the tax cuts that he wants to continue from his first administration, plus some additional ones, and massive spending cuts to try and offset those tax cuts. And so this is, what he wants is one big, beautiful bill that contains both. And so the only way you're going to get that through the Senate is if you use the reconciliation process, which allows you to bypass filibuster. So, the Democrats in the Senate wouldn't sign off on these tax cuts or the spending. And so they have to do a parliamentary maneuver in order to avoid, having this filibuster from the Democrats in the Senate. And that's called reconciliation. And so what they can do with reconciliation is they can pass a budget resolution, which the House did a couple of weeks ago. The Senate hasn't taken it up yet. That gives instructions to each one of the congressional committees on what they're supposed to do. That could be either raise funds through taxes or cut funds through tax decreases or cut spending. And so they tell after this resolution, they tell each committee what they need to do in broad terms. And then after they pass this resolution, those committees go about, finding the details and exactly what's going to be cut.
Let's talk about the policy of this as opposed to the politics, because when you're talking about cuts and slash and burn, which is what Elon Musk is doing with Doge, and he's admitted so much, saying that, he's made some mistakes. He's not going to bat 1,000 all of the time. Of course, you're talking about government policy here. He's not been elected to do anything. I know the president appointed him to his position, a newly created position, if you will. But this is really no way to run a business, let alone the U.S. government, right? This continuing resolution foolishness or rushing into some kind of big, beautiful bill in a couple of months?
I mean, if it goes through the continuing resolution, I agree. This is just a stopgap measure because Congress doesn't essentially do its job on time. There's a difference between that and the big, beautiful bill. That's that's essentially using a normal congressional process in order to, pass standard legislation. So that would follow essentially the constitutional process. And that's going to take a while. I mean,
that's the point I was making, Professor. When it comes to think that you would pass a big, beautiful bill to avoid a government shutdown, there's no way you could evaluate what needs to be cut, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense before March, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. 100% right. Yeah, if they get this bill out in the fall, I think they will be success. That would be counted as success. They want to avoid going into next year. That's the goal. There's no way this is happening prior to March 14th.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll come back. We're talking about what we're looking at with a government shutdown and the political maneuverings between Republicans and the Democrats. We'll talk about where the Republicans are with this. Lindsey Graham has some disagreements. We'll also talk about Elon Musk and Doge and what part they play in all of this. Any questions, comments? Open Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Lines open, 504-260-1870. Time for traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Dusso, our friend, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis, about the government shutdown. Maybe, might happen, probably won't, right, Professor? Because tell me historically what happens with government shutdowns. Does anybody win this politically?
Historically, the government shutdowns that have happened over the last 30 years have actually kind of rebounded and hurt the Republicans because they tend to be the one that was in charge of Congress, then basically shut down the government on a Democratic president, and then public opinion has seemingly weighed against them. This is an opposite situation right now, where if we have a government shutdown, I don't think Republicans are the ones that want it, and so it would be the choice of Democrats to shut the government down, which I don't think they do.
So it's easy to, just get in line. And I don't mean this disrespectfully to anybody. It'll just, and that's why political parties exist. It's like, look, I don't want to sort through all of this. I'm just going to say that he's my guy or she's my woman. I'm not going to do my own thinking. I'm going to let them think it through for me and just trust them to do the right thing. But yet when you see surveys on Congress people, they come in with what, like a 7 or 8% approval rating. So that's a disconnect there. But for the average American, how would they go about knowing what's best for them or what isn't best for them? Or does it depend on whether you're of means or not, or how dependent you are on aid from the government? And before we break that down to individuals, you got to talk about states, because Louisiana is one of the, I think, top 10 states when it comes to getting more from the federal government than we send in.
I think this is actually one of the central problem that we have in a democratic society like ours. It's that it's very complex, and it is actually very difficult to understand what policy effects might be and how they might rebound on you. And so this is such a big challenge that ultimately most people aren't going to spend the time. I don't necessarily blame them, but they're not going to spend the time in order to figure it out for themselves because it's just too much. I mean, they've got other problems that are more pressing. And so what happens is they just ultimately turn to what we would call opinion leaders, right? And that's oftentimes a political party. So they'll simply have a partisan identification and they'll go along with what the party tells them with the assumption that the party's not going to screw them over in some way. But the reality is that it, you know, most Americans simply don't understand how government affects them. And this can be shown in polling about Medicare. Medicare is a government program, but it's oftentimes administered by private companies. And so people are oftentimes confused as to what's actually helping them. They don't realize that that's actually a government program. And so it's government helping you.
Yeah, I remember during the Obamacare years, it was keep the government out of my Medicare. And it was like, well, you know, that is a government program. And sometimes the truth can be an inconvenient thing. So when it comes to what the polls show with Americans and approval, disapproval of what Elon Musk is doing, where does that stand, Professor? Do you know?
The polling for Elon Musk is gone way down. He used to be a fairly popular individual, but since he's become involved with the presidential administration, obviously this DOGE efforts to cut things, his approval ratings have tanked, and you can see that even in rebounding on Tesla, and its stock market has dropped 40% in value. So this is having big effects on people.
And even the bill that that big, beautiful bill, I forget exactly what bill it was, but with the tax cuts, it would still increase the debt, would it not? By $16 trillion, there would be $11 trillion over here, but then the end result would be a $16 trillion increase. Do I remember that correctly?
Right. Yeah. So the bill, it hasn't even existed yet, so we haven't even started. Once they get the budget resolutions passed, that's the beginning. And so then they'll work on actually crafting that bill. And right now, the way it's structured, it suggests that it'll increase the deficit by $2 to $3 trillion over 10 years.
And that's, I just want people, I was wrong about it, $2 to $3 trillion. You're talking about the debt or the deficit per year?
It would be the debt.
Debt,
so
by $3
trillion. Over 10 years.
By yep. $3 trillion.
Up to $3 trillion.
Up to $3 trillion. Okay, and I just want people to keep their eye on the bottom line and the numbers to know, while we talk about cutting spending, what's going on with the debt that we accumulate and continue to add on to. Thank you, Professor Aaron Dussault. We'll take a break. Come back with Mike Strain, Commissioner of the Department of Louisiana of Agriculture and Forestry. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7, Thursday morning. That's time to talk to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, also a very gifted veterinarian. How you doing, Mike?
Man, I am doing great. It's Lent, it's seafood time. Crawfish is on the menu, and shrimp, oysters, and crabs, gumbo. It's really great. And, of course, this week you have Ash Wednesday and you have a Friday, you know, dedicated to seafood, so... Look, it just doesn't get any better than that. And it spring's here. I think we're through the freezes. You know, we're starting to get our crops in the ground, so everything is moving forward.
Dave Cohen wanted me to tell you thank you for the sweet potato idea. He said he put his sweet potatoes in a crawfish boil on Tuesday, and they were delicious.
Good. And any sweet potatoes left over, you can wrap them in tin foil and put them in the refrigerator, and then you can take them out. You can heat them up in the microwave, or you can set them if you're cooking some steaks or something on the side of the grill, and it's like a twice baked sweet potato. Well, yeah, a little bit of spice, but absolutely delicious.
Hi, Mike. You're a veterinarian. Let me ask you this: there's a new member of the Tucker family, Teddy TT. I call him because he's a pitler, he gets a little excited. And some other people texted in after I mentioned that. Is there anything? Do dogs outgrow that, or once they're pitlers, are they pitlers? How does that work?
Well, most do outgrow that. What you need to do is make sure you bring, Teddy outside frequently. And when you first come home, bring Teddy outside right away. Don't really Teddy excited, overexcited.
Mike, let me tell you what I have to do. I have to park the car on the street so he doesn't hear it. Then I have to run in and unlock the door and quickly unlock the patio door, open the cage, and run out to the grass. But even at that, I still have to quickly spin him around and pet him from the back. Otherwise, well, you know.
Yep. He'll get better. He will get better. They're excited to see you. They've been in the cage. But you're doing the right thing by putting them in the cage. And when you're coming home, bringing them out right away.
Yeah,
so they can saying they need to go in the grass, and they'll get better. What type of dog is it?
It's a combination of everything. It's a mutt. No, it's a rescue, but it's a good dog. Really is. He's a good dog.
That's right. Yeah. Very sound genetics. Very well bred. Well, good. Good for Teddy. Good for you. I'm glad. I'm happy for you.
Well, thank you. And how's Hootie doing? Speaking of dogs,
Hootie is doing great. Every day is Hooterific. Doing well. You know, growing continuously. Just having the time of her life. You know, she loves it on holidays when we're home. You know, but about 7 o'clock at night, she tuckers out, and you look around for her, and she's sleeping in the chair. But she's good. She does her patrol out here on the farm and checks things out, then comes back, tell Mama everything's okay, and gets up on the chair and takes a nap.
Just about every day has been Teddy Grow around these parts, but let's move on. Let's talk about somebody texted in. I found this interesting. I got a couple of different texts, so I'm going to combine them, if I will. And it says, trying to ask Mike Strain about farmers and tariffs. What impact will tariffs have on farm exports? Do subsidies to farmers offset loss of markets such as the Chinese soybean loss that happened previously? Talk about all of that, because here's my thing. If we wind up with subsidizing farmers for tariffs,
easy.
If we wind up subsidizing farmers for tariffs, well, then the taxpayers are paying the tariffs, right?
Well, what happens if there's tariffs? Normally what they do, they'll take the tariff money and set it aside and use those dollars to offset any injury to industries affected by the tariffs. And so that's what's been done in the past. If you look at the market for soybeans, you know, more than a third of the soybeans that we raise, we have to sell offshore. Now, China has traditionally been our largest customer, but that is changing. We focused on other countries. China is actually not our largest customer anymore. Our largest trading partners actually are Canada and Mexico, but we're moving into India and to other markets. For the last several years, we've been focusing on lesser or smaller markets to move our products. And so China has been buying more and more of the soybeans from Brazil and other parts of the world for the last several years. And so it's actually not as big a deal as it once was. Now, with all that said, all the tariffs are still under continuous negotiation. As you saw yesterday, and they haven't announced it yet, with Canada and Mexico, they were discussing about bringing those tariffs down maybe to, quote, 12.5% to 15%. And so all that's in flux. Also what's happening is that there are being carve-outs of different products from the tariffs. For instance, with Canada, they're pushing very hard for carve-outs for potash fertilizer because 38% of the potash fertilizer produced in the world comes from Canada, and we use a great deal of it in the United States, but also in piglets. We import a lot of pigs there. So none of this is set in stone yet. Overall, there's a discussion that due to the tariffs, we could see, if they're fully implemented at 25% and then they're retaliatory tariffs, we could see an increase in food prices of 0.7% by and large. So if they come in at 12.5%, you would see that at about a 3.5% increase in food prices.
But if, and I'm just trying to get to tariffs here, if taxpayers pay, if the government pays subsidies to farmers to offset tariffs, then it's not the country, the foreign country paying the tariffs, it's our country paying the tariffs, correct?
Well, the tariff money collected from the foreign country on the goods they ship here will go into a fund. And generally, the money's in that fund is what is used to offset whatever industry is affected by the tariffs from the reciprocal tariffs. Does that make sense?
So
it's
it
not
does.
Directly. It is not. It's designed not to be directly from the taxpayer paying in the taxes.
So who's paying the tariff? When the tariff on the product, when it comes in, now we're talking about agricultural products.
So it could be any products. When they set the tariffs, then that money goes into a pool. And from that pool, whatever industries are negatively impacted, then generally the government will help to offset that until all that equilibrates. It's generally a short time, maybe a one-time payment, but it is not a continuous payment. But that's what's under that system.
Well, it's interesting. I'm trying to learn about this. So a tariff, then, the country that is importing, upon which the tariff is placed, pays the tariff to the U.S. Treasury, and then the U.S. Treasury can use, yes?
Yeah, so in other words, if say we collect tariffs from China, Canada, or Mexico on whatever goods, those dollars go into generally a fund. And from that...
Wait, those dollars from whom go where, Mike?
The reciprocal tariff. The reciprocal tariff. In other words, when we sell goods, in other words, for us, we're selling soybeans, for instance, to China. That would be a reciprocal tariff in that particular case. So there, that would cause, you know, cost of our soybeans to go up and lessen our market, which could actually drive down the net price that the farmers get for the soybeans.
I guess I'm still trying to figure out who pays the tariff to who. So if China...
Ultimately, consumers in both countries, okay. Right? Because at the end of the day, the tariffs are paid by consumers and the producers both. So what we see now, you know, if you're looking at, for instance, tariffs on rice, export tariffs on rice, a number of the countries on the number of the buyers. So the buyers will be telling the suppliers, look, I can't pay you as much as I was paying you because now I have to pay a tariff. But at the end of the day, they're going to have to pay a tariff if their country imposes a tariff on the American product. In other words, the retaliatory tariff.
I'm trying to move from the
saying what they're going to do
from the cash from the politics of the cash register and the wallet is what I'm trying to do. 6:53, 7 till 7. Quick break, Mike. When we come back, people want to talk about eggs and the price of eggs and what's going to happen with that. Traffic now. WWL. 6:57 a half. Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Mike, let's talk about egg prices and what's going on there and bird flu. And have they gotten a handle on that? And tell me what's going to happen with that.
Well, last week I was with Secretary Rollins, and she talked about it twice, once at dinner on Tuesday night and then formally on Wednesday. And believe it or not, the first item of discussion in the Trump's first cabinet meeting was eggs. And so there's a five-prong approach that she announced for combating the avian flu. One, increase biosecurity and really pushing that. Two, increase research. And then the development of vaccine and then instituting a vaccine. Where there's vaccines being developed for livestock and poultry, and end of the day, that's where we've got to get. So right now with our egg inventory, eggs, average dozen price for large eggs is around $8.30. Across the United States, it's about $8.20. And the good news is we're stable. There's been what we call demand destruction. In other words, people aren't buying as many eggs because of the cost. But inventories are very low. Still, it's going to take some time to rebuild those flocks of chickens. That's the bottom line. But we are working on and really looking at vaccinating these hens. And at the end of the day, that's what we've got to do is develop a vaccine program and rebuild that to get those price of eggs where you can go to the store and get them for $1.29 or $2. And that's at the end of the day what we have to do. And we are working on that diligently. But biosecurity right now is the key, and that's everyone's concern in the egg industry.
Thought about you Tuesday. We had Rex's Majesty, King of Carnival, a successful attorney, lives uptown. Guess what he does? Raises chickens.
That's right.
And
he loves it. I tell my chickens, you better not get sick. And they look at me like, well, that's your job. Keep us from getting sick.
Dr. Mike Strain, it is. Mike Strain, thank you, sir. Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. A pleasure as always. We learn something new every time he's on. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Greg Upton, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies. Louisiana's emerged as a hotbed for carbon capture projects, but there's been a pushback. We'll talk about that. Then we'll go to the Vatican to check in on Pope Francis. So a lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL.